Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Good morning. Welcome to another week of Elder Talk. With me returning this week is Susan Arthur.
I am very glad to be back. I would much rather be sitting here across the table from you than hanging out in the hospital room, which is what we were doing.
Well, you know, if I can beat a hospital room, then at least that's something.
Well, the good news is my son is recovering and seems to be doing well. He's back at school and trying to play catch up from all of the last 2.5-3 months that he missed with all of his health issues. So.
Well, that's good. You know, it's tough when kids especially have to deal with the hospital. You know, we kind of think about that's something that especially older adults deal with. But you think when you're a kid, you're not supposed to be in a hospital.
That's exactly right. And I'll tell you that whole thing of he's an adult, but not really, is a little bit tricky sometimes.
Yes.
But it was interesting. I'll tell you a little story. I was able to listen to the program last week, and you were talking about how sometimes you'll have a form to fill out in the hospital. Honest to goodness, that came in. They asked him, they said, "Do you have a living will?" And he went, "What?" He was coming out of anesthesia, and they kind of explained it to him, and he said, "Sure, I'll get one of those," not having a clue what he was really getting. So they came back the next day, and I thought, boy, this is exactly what Joe talked about.
Well, you know, and there is this sort of gray netherworld between the rights of an adult and the rights of a child. Mm-hmm. And as parents, we find that the territory that we control seems to shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And that we find that there are more independence that children have, especially regarding certain areas of health care.
Mm-hmm.
So it is important to have documents in place that assure parents access.
Well, and as we continue to age, then we almost go back to the other extreme. So then suddenly the kids are taking care of us, and that's how we've been, you know, it's a great transition to get into what we finished with last week, talking about healthcare concerns. But, you know, all of a sudden, as we age, our kids are going to be helping to make those decisions, and we want to try and get some of our wants and wishes in there as well.
And that's a good place to think about where we were last week. You know, I kind of took the opportunity to talk about the importance of people being in a position to plan and being in a position to determine now who's going to make decisions for the balance of their lives. They can be at the mercy of a court system, they can be at the mercy of the rules that various legislatures have passed, or they can instead be governed by the decisions that they themselves have made or by those that they've appointed to make decisions for them. And that's the reason that a durable power of attorney is a huge, important component. It's a critical foundation, one of those four or five elements that have got to be there if you're to have any confidence that you're going to be protected as you age.
Well, and I love how you explained it last week of you need to know the rules and know your predators. And then we're kind of into that knowing your options part. But the government can make those decisions for you, or you can make those decisions. And that's kind of what it comes down to, is either who's going to make the decisions, who's going to decide where your stuff goes. And I, you know, the other thing that I just kind of want to recap on is you made a great point talking about at the end of the program last week, we were talking about trusts and how a trust is really a safety net for you. And it kind of guards your stuff. A trust does not keep things from your heirs or from you, but it keeps them safe for you. And I thought that is a great way to look at that and very easy to remember. It's not keeping things from you. It's keeping them safe for you.
Yeah. And a lot of people have this notion that's been around for a long time that, look, when I die, I'm going to simply give my stuff away. You know, checks will be written immediately. And people will have their inheritances and go on their way. And there are many reasons that that's often a bad idea. And you can go down the list of the possible pitfalls that are just routine scenarios that families all can identify, either people they know or people within their families who've had similar difficulties. For example, let's assume that a couple has a blended family,
mm-hmm.
a routine phenomenon in America. Mm-hmm. Blended family, they go into a lawyer, they do estate planning. The estate planning provides that that when the first spouse dies, of course, the surviving spouse, you know, will continue to have all the assets. And then when the surviving spouse dies, then he or she will have the assets distributed in full to the children. So that's the plan that's in place. That's what both of these parents sign. And they sign it in fairness and good faith. It's not the intention that statistically often stepmom is the survivor. Mm-hmm. So it's not the intention of stepmom, for example, to end up disinheriting the kids. It happens because over time the parties detach from each other in the way that they were before dad came along as that uniting element. Now, it's different when stepmom comes along. The kids are little. Granted, there's almost a parent-child relationship there. Mm-hmm. So it occurs far less frequently in that scenario. But in the more common scenario where you have a blended family, the kids are almost adults or are adults or even deep into adulthood when the marriage takes place. And despite the warmth and friendship and good relations that appear between them, and those are real, I'm sure, that is hardly the basis on which to rest your plans for the legacy of your children. Mm-hmm. So what happens is dad dies and this gradual disengagement often occurs. No one is necessarily to blame. Sometimes maybe one more than the other. But what happens is the kids go one way and maybe they quit sending birthday cards or coming by around Christmas or maybe stepmom starts dating someone. Mm-hmm. So that for the parties to have sat in that lawyer's office 25 years before or 20 years before, they sat there and they came up with a plan that I think all of us should agree it doesn't require a Monday morning quarterback to identify the flaws in it. That was foreseeable, and it should have been done differently.
Well, and I think sometimes even when you add in perhaps another child between the stepmom and the dad, I mean, then that adds a whole different dynamic to it as well, because you've got hurt feelings and jealousy sometimes gets in there. And again, nobody intends it to happen, but the reality is it can and it often does.
Yeah. And it's our responsibilities as planners and our meaning clients with the advice and assistance of lawyers, but it's the parents whose responsibility it is to make the wise decisions about their family and their legacy. Another common scenario, incidentally, is let's assume that the parties have been married for many years, husband, wife married many years, dad dies, mom goes on, and then she remarries. Now, let's go back again to that scenario that they're sitting in a lawyer's office 20 years before, they prepared these documents, they have children, but the plan didn't allow for the possibility that a survivor might remarry. Hmm. Now, is that a risk to a plan?
Oh, sure.
I mean, if you were the children, especially, and you were observing these events as they will, if they occur, it would they have good reason to be concerned that maybe things could go awry? I mean, we could list those possibilities, but we all agree that there are possibilities, including our simple distrust of this third person that's come into the family.
Mm-hmm.
So could that have been prevented? And the answer is, of course. I mean, by planning with trust, you can provide more security, more protection without inhibiting someone's access even in a meaningful way to the funds they need.
Well, and I think an interesting concept to it is that when someone meets with you or meets with an elder care attorney or an advisor, they are able to take the emotion out of it. You know, so much of the time we get caught up in the emotional aspects of it, you know, and having a third party there who can say, okay, this may be true, but let's look at it logically, pulling you back into those taking the emotional aspects out of it is really a good thing.
No question. And it's one of the responsibilities of a lawyer who's helping someone plan, and especially I would say elder lawyers who mm-hmm. often are working with even older adults. And sometimes they may not be at their sharpest at that stage. And I think that it creates more responsibility on the part of the lawyer to help shoulder some of that that challenge. And let me point out, too, that we can all look around us and see situations where we know there was estate planning done and it didn't end up well. And more often than not, when we look back, while, yes, we ask ourselves, why did that ancestor, that family member, do that way? But as much you can ask, why did the lawyer not encourage them to do differently? And you have to wonder. It's always possible the lawyer encouraged them, but you suspect maybe not. So I think of this case with Lisa Marie Presley.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just shocking to me. I was asked to comment on this on an interview on another radio station a few weeks ago. And the question was, how is it that someone gets $100 million estate, Elvis Presley Enterprises, at 25 years old, and then, of course, proceeds to completely squander that fortune? And here she is today, almost broke, filing an action against her financial advisors with the allegation that they didn't give her good advice. The suspicion is that maybe had she not been in the number of celebrity marriages, which were not fruitful ventures for her, had she not spent money on private jets and such things as that, that perhaps the money would have gone further, mm-hmm. whether or not her financial advisors were as good as they should have been. But you know, you really look at that and you think Elvis was disserved by his advisor. I mean, what lawyer would have said that you should come up with a plan where the entirety of Elvis Presley Enterprises is handed over to somebody when they turn 25?
Right.
I mean, that's such a naive and foolish plan. And now, in defense of the lawyer, you know, it's possible that lawyer just passionately said to Elvis, you know, now this would be a mistake, you need to keep it in trust, blah, blah, blah. But you suspect that maybe it wasn't that emphatically communicated. But we know it was a bad decision.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And incidentally, Elvis can't be off the hook.
Right.
I mean, we as human beings can form the opinions that our children at age 25 are not capable of certain decisions. So I don't think that this is entirely the lawyer's fault.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Elvis, of whom I'm a big fan, incidentally, musically at least, mm-hmm. I just think that he dropped the ball on this one. And it was an important pass.
Well, and I think so much of the time probably didn't think that his demise was imminent. We always think that we have more time and we fail to plan.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it could have been a scenario where he assumed that she would be older.
Mm-hmm.
So it would the age 25 wouldn't have come into play because she would. But even then, I mean, 30, 35, 40, what age is? And my argument is that there is no age when, again, depending on the amount of the money, when you should simply dump the money in the lap. But I would partner that argument with another argument that they dovetail nicely, and that's that whenever you use a trust, and I'm a big fan of trust, those of you who have heard me talk about this topic before, you know this. Yes, trust costs you a little bit more than a will, but the things you can do with a trust are just tremendous. And this is a good example. Let's assume then that you want to plan for the possibility that your children may not have the best judgment in the world. It may be that your children have good judgment, but you know that there are predators out there and you want to be extra cautious in assuring that the legacy that you've left them lasts as long as it can and gives them the maximum amount of benefit over time. So there's a much better way to do that than simply having a check written by the executor 6 months after you die.
Mm-hmm.
A much better way.
And what is that way? We've talked about some predators. We've talked about government being a predator. We've talked about just maybe some unwise counsel in there or unwise decisions. Are there other things that are predators in our estate planning?
Well, and that's a good place to take a break. You asked a great question, and hang on, the listeners, I believe, will be interested in the answer to this question. We'll be back in just a moment. Elder Talk, Joe Cordell, Susan Arthur. Thank you.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA, Joe Cordell.
So the question is, how do you protect your stuff more effectively than just writing checks for the value of your assets when you die to your loved ones?
Predators. We always have people that are coming in, and I love that word. It's like gives me a good word picture.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes predators, incidentally, are intentional, and sometimes they're unintentional, but the damage they do is the same.
Exactly.
So we shouldn't treat them differently. And on the list of predators, we have to include government, of course. On any list of threats to our well-being, we always include government. But in addition, there's long-term care costs. I mean, that is a threat to any plan. And we're talking about numbers that can devastate mm-hmm. a plan. I mean, $12,000 a month indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, any plan potentially goes out the window when you run into that sort of obstacle. What else is there? Well, we do include family, the list of predators, some of whom are intentional and some of whom are unintentional. But again, the damage that happens through those elements in the plan is still real. And often, you know, you have to realize that it's the more the people within the plan who's going to cause problems for it than the people without it.
Mm-hmm.
Keep that in mind when you're planning. So, and of course, there's also outside forces such as civil lawsuits, creditors, other people who might be coming making claims, valid or invalid, and often invalid. But sometimes, you know, we have loved ones who may not manage resources real well. We have to recognize that we have to protect them from creditors,
mm-hmm.
and we have to protect them from themselves. So the most effective way to do that is with a trust. And here's the beauty of a trust, is that you can imagine a continuum. You give your loved one as little or as much control and access as you're comfortable with. And if you have five kids, I'm going to be suspicious of any plan that gives the equal amount of access and control to all five.
Okay, but wait a minute. That doesn't feel good as a parent.
I know, and it doesn't feel good as a kid, I'm sure.
Exactly.
But now think about this, though, for a moment. And you have to weigh, on the one hand, potentially offending one of your children, and on the other hand, putting them in a position where they're going to be broke soon. And
right.
then they're going to come into their siblings and wanting money, or at least resenting the fact their siblings have money and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, whenever you have children that you know are strong in terms of decision making, you know that they tend to have good heads on their shoulders. So you still want to give them protection. It's not that good judgment protects you from all these forces we just mentioned. It does not. Even with those people, you would never simply write a check. And the reason is that you can give them more than simply X amount of dollars. Let me use a number for the sake of discussion. Let's assume that somebody has $500,000 and they have, say, five kids. So let's make it $1 million in five kids so I can bring the number up to $200,000 each.
Okay.
So let's assume that you have $200,000. You can give it to this good managing kid, this level-headed, you know, person whose judgment you don't question. You can give it to them and be sure that they're not going to waste it. But what if you could give it to them in a package, in a container, that allowed them to still be able to have their children qualify for loans and grants and other sorts of state and federal benefits if they were disabled? Now, don't just because your grandkids are not disabled, don't assume that they're never going to be disabled. Things happen.
That's true.
And so what about if the person had the ability that in that scenario, for example, that those assets would not be considered theirs and they would qualify for all those state and federal programs? So you know, you may be saying, okay, disability is a far-fetched for me. Okay, is it a far-fetched that maybe your grandchildren might apply for some sort of aid to go to college?
I was just thinking student loans or scholarships or things like that.
Grants. Yeah. I mean, they're almost all need-based these days. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can tell you I have two daughters in college, and and anything that comes in the mail that asks the parents to fill out a financial form.
Yeah, we don't qualify.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you that those ceilings are very low. And you don't have to be rich by any of our definitions in order to be disqualified. So if you leave money to your children of any significant amount, I can tell you that that's going to disqualify them in terms of qualifying for those sorts of benefits to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So what about the issue of, I mean, accidents happen. I mean, so you're driving down the road, your grandchild or your child has an automobile accident. Lawsuit happens. Gavel goes down, you know, city jury, who may make their judgment on factors other than the merits of the case. And so suddenly you have this judgment against you for $1 million. And maybe there's not insurance to cover that amount of liability. Well, guess what? If you've written a check at out of your estate, then that money's gone.
So all $200,000 would be gone.
Gone. So, I mean, the point is, this isn't about how good the judgment is of your children. It's about doing better for them than they could otherwise do for themselves. The same reason you parented them for 18 years in the home. All those decisions you made were based upon the idea that you felt a duty to give them the best benefits possible. And you can do that similarly with estate planning. And writing a check is not doing that. But many people are under the impression that that if your kids are responsible, then you write checks. And that's not true, because you can do much better for that responsible child than simply hand them. And those three examples I just gave you are wonderful illustrations. And I'll mention another one. What about the prospect of divorce? Hmm. I mean, none of us want to believe that our kids will get divorced, but we know that it happens statistically. Now, I know that I can talk to the dads out there, and I'm sure the moms as well, but I identify with the dads. I mean, can you think of many things that would bother you more than to know that half of what you and your wife have worked for is going to end up in the hands of the person that maybe you like least in this world? Hmm. And that's what happens in divorce. And I can tell you from Cordell and Cordell, Cordell and Cordell is probably the largest domestic relations firm in the country. And we have close to 300 lawyers, and they're highly skilled at establishing through.
And see this every single day.
Every day. And, yeah. and they're highly skilled at having judges rule that gifts made to wives from their parents, parents giving their daughters things that they thought, you know, were a legacy for their grandchildren through their daughters, in fact, end up in the hands of our clients, half of it at least. And it's very difficult to keep a gift like that or an inheritance as a separate asset. It's possible, but I can tell you as a practical matter, it just doesn't happen, because there's too many missteps that can happen. There's too many ways in which it becomes commingled. And you just have to assume that if a divorce comes along, then that inheritance is going to end up as a marital asset. So can you prevent that? Of course you can. And should you? I think you should. And the way you do that is through a trust. So each of these illustrations I've given are just some of the reasons that it just simply doesn't make sense to write checks to your loved ones. And you'll notice the common denominator of all these things that I've listed. They assume that your child has wonderful judgment, is very responsible, and aren't really screwing up in these cases. Now let's include the cases where you have kids that are not responsible and who screw up. And now let's list those reasons. But you don't really need me to list those, but I'll mention a couple of them. I mean, let me give you what I can tell you is sage legal judgment. And that's that if your child is incapable of managing $100 or $1,000, when you give them $100,000 or $200, it doesn't improve. Mm-mm. And I think that you all don't realize that. And similarly, I mean, things like if you have a child that has perhaps a little smoldering addiction, meaning not something full-blown, but we all read in the paper and we hear about the issues with chemical addictions of various sorts, including alcohol, but especially other things as well. And many of us know families that struggle with this. Some of the people I'm listening to, some of your families, you know, you may be dealing with this. But the point is, oftentimes, you know, what otherwise would be a raging sort of addiction is instead contained to some extent because of the financial limitations of the person. And suddenly that person receives a large sum of money. And when this is deposited in their lap, guess where that money is likely to go? So what otherwise might not have been such a destructive habit suddenly becomes an inferno because they've gotten the resources to do it. Another interesting piece of information that you might not know, and that's that, do you know that the chances of bankruptcy actually increase for someone who, without prior experience, receives large sums of money? Hmm. You've seen this with lottery winners?
That's what I was just thinking. I've heard about that with the lottery winners.
And you see it especially with people, though, who inherit large amounts of money. And it seems counterintuitive, but here's the reason. As long as you're broke, it's kind of hard to go bankrupt, meaning that you don't have the opportunity to incur massive debts.
Right.
Banks are not going to give you a $1 million line of credit. They're not going to give you a $50,000 or $100,000 loan. But once you have some money, these people get drawn into deals they don't know anything about, but suddenly they become targets. I mean, believe me, when people inherit money, word gets around, and anybody who has a shady investment is going to come to them. Of course, they don't have the judgment to know. And so suddenly you have the ability to end up actually in debt hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. And previously, when you're broke, you just simply can't – you don't get the opportunity to end up that much in debt, because no one gives you that opportunity.
Right.
But those people, when you read about them in the paper, you think, how is it that person – had $1 million and now they file bankruptcy and they owe people $3 million. How does that happen? Well, it happens because once you inherit that kind of money, banks and other investors will come to you and give you the chance to go in the hole $5 million mm-hmm. with credit. And so the bottom line is that you can't assume that your children have perfect judgment. You can recognize that some of them have very good judgment, some of them don't, but don't assume any have perfect judgment.
Well, and this is even kind of more along the lines of the emotional aspect, but let's say, you know, as a mom, I want to have family harmony, and I want to be able to just kind of keep my kids happy and keep everything going along. And so I really want to have that. And so I think sometimes when you give one child the responsibility or you give one child more of the money, then they're not going to be always able to have the family harmony because suddenly someone is jealous of why did mom give you that? How come mom gave you more money or mom and dad gave you more money? They don't trust me. What do you mean? And so you've created this entire area of family tension that most parents do not want to leave a legacy of with their children.
No. And I know that you can't ignore those relationships. I get it. So how do you come up with a proper balance? I think that you create trust for each of the kids, and these trusts come into play automatically when you create your original trust. In other words, no one has to go back to a lawyer. This unfolds automatically according to plan. It's written into the original documents. And once that's done, you can decide. You can say, well, I'm not going to discriminate in the provisions of this trust. So what that would mean is that if you have three kids with wonderful judgment, and two kids with judgment you know is very questionable, you would end up having to put all five children with the same conditions of their payout, which would mean, for example, that none of them would be their own trustee.
Right.
But let me suggest an alternative, those of you who are comfortable with it. Those who are comfortable of acknowledging to some that you have less confidence in their judgment than to others, and perhaps that's something you've expressed to all in the presence of all. I mean, in rearing kids, you have these frank conversations, and they're in the presence of everyone else. And if you're comfortable going ahead and making that distinction, as you did in many ways in these kids' lives, you did that, I think, in a number of ways, certainly before they left the home, and then you do have different terms in the trust, and maybe you do allow some of the kids to be a co-trustee and some not. But the bottom line is that's a parenting decision you're going to have to make. And if you feel so strongly that you have to create them evenly, then I would create them the same by putting the strictest terms in for everyone. Mm-hmm. I don't think the solution is to treat them the same by giving the irresponsible kids the loose access conditions that you would give the responsible kids because they're going to, you know, it's just going to not be good. They will end up without money, and that's not a satisfying outcome, I don't think. But that's a parenting decision that you can make. The good news is once you've arrived at that point in the decision process and you're thinking, you've implicitly acknowledged that what needs to be in place are rules and conditions that allow this money to be worth so much more, to be so much more beneficial than it would otherwise be. But, yeah, I have to figure out exactly, you know, how much control I'm going to give. A common provision, for those of you who are wondering, you know, what might a payout look like then? Well, what I commonly see and what our clients often want is something where they know the income is going to always be paid out, except there's a condition. It's called a spendthrift clause, a wonderful condition. The spendthrift clause says that in the event that someone initiates a civil action of some sort or some threat appears on the horizon, then the trustee has the discretion to stop paying out income. Those of you who are confused by that, the reason you have to have a provision like that is if the income is required to be paid out, then it means that someone can attach it. It means that if you know it's going to come out and it's going to go into the bank, then a court can issue an order that's when it's paid out, it's to go to so-and-so, for example. But if the terms allow the trustee to have the discretion to discontinue payment under certain conditions, then that means that there is no judgment to attach. That means that anybody who goes to court and gets and files a lawsuit and wins, there's nothing they can do with that. They can't take it to the trustee and say, here, you're required to pay out this money. Pay it to me. Hmm. because the trustee's not required to pay it out. That's called a spendthrift provision, and that you'd want for all of your kids.
So you decide that per child?
Well, you do that for all your kids. Okay. Spendthrift provision should be there for all the kids, okay. Incidentally, something like that. But another way in which it might work on a daily basis is it's called, there's something, it's an acronym, it's called HEMS, Health, Education, Maintenance, and Support. Now, if you think about those four words, health, education, maintenance, support, there's some haziness there, but yet there's enough specificity to where courts have long recognized what those terms mean in the event that this ever ended up in a court about for enforcement. And I don't want to get confused people that are listening. So I just want you to say, I want to make the point to you that HIMSS is not just some entirely vague, nebulous cloud of words. Instead, it's something that does have some meaning. And what happens on the ground is that there would be payouts for important things like maybe a down payment on a house, some educational costs. Another provision we include, similar to the spendthrift provision, is that the trustee is forbidden to pay out anything in advance of the recipient's application or exhaustion for resources from any other direction. So in other words, it requires them to exhaust the opportunity that they might have had to get state or federal funds. Okay. So this is huge. And this way, having the trust in place in no way can be regarded as a substitution or a basis for not awarding any sort of aid or grant.
So if you qualify for a grant for your child's or your grandchild's education, they are still eligible to it, even if they have this trust hanging out there kind of in the future.
Yeah, so now think about the benefits of these terms. The spendthrift provision means that if some threat comes on the horizon, you know, you can raise the drawbridge. Raise the drawbridge and protect the money as long as the threat's out there. That's wonderful. I don't care if your kid is a financier on Wall Street. As a matter of fact, if your kid's a financier on Wall Street, he's the first that will say, give me that. Because financiers on Wall Street know the value of that. And the similar thing is the provision about first exhausting any alternative sources of income. You know, that's a wonderful provision. And so you'd want that for all your kids.
It sounds to me like the trust has so much flexibility that you've got to have really good conversations with your advisor on the things that you want to have in there. And, you know, these are things we've been talking about trusts off and on for over a year. And I'm the first time hearing about some of this. And I thought, well, you know, we need to have good conversations so that you can actually, the trust in the document itself will be representative of my wishes and desires.
Yeah, and I'm going to continue walking this through a little bit to show you some of the cool stuff you can do with these trusts. We're going to take another break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors. Presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Okay, before we went into the break, we were talking about some of the ways in which you can draft a trust if you have multiple kids to kind of allow for the variations in among the kids in terms of how well they manage money. But more than anything else, I wanted to point out to you that while that's important and you can make your own judgment the extent to which you'll have provisions that will discriminate a little bit to allow for their ability, the important thing is to recognize that for any child, no matter how good their judgment, a trust gives them so much more. If they could know all the benefits that came with having a trust, they would always choose to have the money in this bulletproof container versus simply having a check. And I can tell you personally that if my parents were wealthy and they said to me, look, we're going to either give you $1 million, hand you a check, or we're going to give you $1 million in this bulletproof container that I've been describing here, I can tell you that I wouldn't pause 10 seconds to say, give me the bulletproof container. Because this container we're talking about here, where it's safe from, in my case, divorce isn't a concern. But anyway, when you're doing your planning, you have to recognize for your kids that however stable their marriage looks, you got to allow for that possibility. But anyway, protection from creditors, allow them to still qualify for all these wonderful benefits for their kids' education, whereas if you left the money to them, they wouldn't. In the event of disability, all those benefits, again, if you left the money, they wouldn't. Mm-hmm. Protection from creditors, lawsuits, bankruptcy, all those threats on the horizon that we all live with in this culture, suddenly they have the benefit of the $1 million. For depending on how generous you or how loose you want to make it, they can have the same as cash effectively or close to it, and still have all these protections. So why would anyone want the check if they could have this in the bulletproof container? But it's incumbent on the parent, though, to teach, to tell their kids, and this is something I tell our clients, look, you've created this wonderful thing for your kids, but you've got to educate them.
That's what I was just thinking. I'm not sure a lot of people really understand. They see the check as something they can put in the bank. And so it can, even if I don't spend it for a while, I don't really see how it's going to. So now you've convinced me that all of these things are great and I need to protect it a little bit more. But then how do I ever have access to that when maybe I want to give my kids, help my kids buy a house. Maybe I want to buy a new house.
Let me give a common scenario. Let's assume then that husband and wife come in, they do planning, and they do a plan which is very common. They'll create a revocable trust, and they can have two revocable trusts, for one for each of them, or they could have a single one with two sub-trusts. But let's assume two separate trusts for sake of discussion. So we kind of divide their assets approximately 50-50. It doesn't have to be exact. But we put it around 50% in husbands, around 50% in wives. Let's assume husband dies. So husband's gone. Now wife survives. Mm-hmm. Now wife's trust, remember, is still revocable, meaning that she can change it, get rid of it. She can do anything she wants with it. But husband's trust is not revocable anymore. His is irrevocable. It became irrevocable when he died. Mm-hmm. Now you may be saying, yeah, but is she going to like that? I mean, does she have full access? Here's what we do. We let her be a trustee, but it's not enough to be just a trustee. Any of you out there, believe it or not, the law often makes sense. And if somebody suggests something to you that doesn't seem to pass the sniff test, then it probably won't. And in order for someone to have all the wonderful protections I've been describing here, you have to assume that there has to be some limitation. And the way you do that is you put a co-trustee on. So it's possible for the surviving spouse, we'll assume the wife. So husband's died, wife's still alive. She has her trust, which is revocable, husband's, which is irrevocable. Husband set it up that to where when he passes, just like she had hers set up, that if husband had passed, and that's that the wife will be a trustee, but she has to have a co-trustee. Now, the reason she has to have a co-trustee is not because the husband just wanted it. It's because the law really requires it in order to have, you know, this protection I've been telling you about. What makes this wonderful container possible is that the person can say, I don't have complete control of this. If they were the trustee and they had complete control of it, then they couldn't make that statement, and the trust loses all of its wonderful charms and benefits. Mm-hmm. So there's a co-trustee. But here's the reason the wife is happy with this. She can hire and fire the co-trustee. Now, if you add that element, is there any practical limitation? So now let's go a step further. So no, I'll introduce a couple of things that happened to her before she dies, and then we'll go to the next generation, all in about, 7-8 minutes here. Let's assume she's driving down the road. Her husband died. She's still grieving, but she's on her iPhone. She screen freezes up. She's trying to get it loose. And guess what? As we might anticipate, there's a car accident, mm-hmm. and somebody dies, mm-hmm. and it's not her, and she's responsible. She sued. Gavel goes down. Big judgment, millions of dollars. Now, is the money that's in her revocable trust gone?
I don't know.
It's gone. I mean, it's revocable, right? I mean, right. Hers.
Oh, hers, right.
Her trust, it's gone. It's fully revocable, so mm-hmm. she has complete control of it. So her half is gone. But there's good news here. The good news is that the other half is not gone. And the reason is that it's in this beautiful Teflon container. So let's assume then that she's a year or two later. She's at dinner one evening. She has a stroke. She goes to the hospital. She's informed, her family's informed that she's going to have to go from there to a nursing home. She may never be able to go home. Now, when the nursing home is doing the intake and they look at her financial statement, is her trust going to be gone, the money in that trust? Yes.
Her trust was gone.
Yeah, because it's revocable. Mm-hmm. So her trust will be gone because it's revocable. That's money the nursing home can take. Now, what about when they say, oh, I see your husband has this really cool trust. You have this money from your husband's trust. I think we'll need that too. And to which she might say, well, you know, I have no objection to giving it to you, but you'll need to talk to my co-trustee, which is my son. But he's a good kid. I'm sure he'll be happy to cooperate. And so they come back to you a day or two later. They say, well, your son wasn't pleasant at all. He was very abrupt with us. And in fact, he said that there was no way that he's going to sign these documents. To which you say, well, gosh darn these kids these days, right? So, I mean, the point is the money safe? It is safe. Now let's keep winding this out. Let's assume then that, so mom now, remember, mom is single at this point. So she's left all this money from the dad's trust as well as hers to, let's assume they have two kids, and Tim and Susie. So they each receive these in own trust under the same terms and conditions, very similar. But let's assume that they're each co-trustees of each other's trust. Now, they don't have to be co-trustees. But the reason it's harmless for kids to be co-trustees in this case is if there's ever any conflict, they can just replace each other. Hmm. But I've found that many of our clients, if they have multiple kids, they like to start out that way because it encourages the kids to work together. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, it's okay. They're not shackled. But setting it up as a co-trustee with a provision that, remember, either can hire and fire, can get rid of a co-trustee, but they have to turn around and get another one. Remember the principle here. There always has to be a co-trustee if you're going to have this wonderful protection that I've described. The best of all worlds. Hmm. The ability to use your money to a great extent without limitation and to still have the sort of protections we're describing. You've got to have a valid co-trustee. So at that point, that the kids each have their own trust. Now, remember, you've told your kids. You an important part of this plan, incidentally, is your kids understand, you know, this money in this container, you don't want to screw it up. Once you take it out, you can't put it back in. Mm. So it has all these protections now from all these risks on the horizon, and it's worth more than it would otherwise be worth because of that. But don't take it out except as you really need it. So this educational process has to take place. But unless a kid is dense on such subjects, they're going to get this. I mean, here's the point. If they don't get this and you think, no, my kid will screw this up, then that answers that question. Don't make them a co-trustee.
Right.
I mean, in other words, put a trustee in that makes the decisions. But in any case, so going forward, this example. So Tim and Susie, they each inherit the money. So Susie calls Tim one night and says, Tim, my husband and I are planning to go down to Florida. We're going to get a condo down there and spend some time. So can you? I need you to sign off on a check for the amount of this down payment or the purchase of the condo. And Tim says, "Well, now Susan, remember what our parents taught us. Let's go ahead and buy it inside your trust. Let's put it in your trust." And Susie, you know, she should. There's no reason for her to say no to that. She should agree that that's a good idea. And so she does, and so the condo's in the trust, and if we wind forward a year or two, her husband and she are down in Florida. Her husband turns out that he's playing a lot of golf, and the hole on which he's especially good, it turns out, is the 19th hole. And he spends a lot of time on that hole. Those of you who don't play golf, that's where the bar is. So he spends a lot of time on that hole. And it turns out that he seems to have a lot in common with a barmaid there.
Hmm.
And it turns out that they decide to each get Harleys and go across the country. And he's told her that he can pay for this entirely. And so she's decided this is a good plan. So he shares his plan with his wife. And he says, oh, incidentally, an important part of our plan is that I need you to sell this condo and I want my half of the money. And this is going to help pay for our cross-country trip with my new friend. Now, those of you who have been following this line of argument here, you know what the answer will be, right? You know the condo is protected. Mm-hmm. The condo is not a marital asset. It will not participate in a divorce. So this is just, you know, one further example of how great it is for you to be able to give your children assets in such a container that they can never create themselves. None of us have the ability to create a container quite that effective with our own money. There are limitations that the law will give when you try to take money and then put it in a container, and then when a creditor comes knocking on your shoulder, say, I'm sorry, or na-na-na-na-na, you can't have this. I mean, so it kind of makes sense that there's some, don't get me wrong, you could do some asset protection things with your own money for yourself, and we advocate that, but you cannot do nearly as much as you can do by giving it to someone else and putting it in their trust and giving it to them, because then their hands are clean. They didn't put their own assets in that container and the creditor is victimized by it. In that case, their hands are entirely clean and the law will enforce that trust. So it's like they have it in a form that is worth far more than the dollars. And once they appreciate this, then they'll never disturb that money. But keep in mind, it's incumbent on you to teach them and tell them that.
Well, and I think it's important too. We have a tendency to think with trust that has to be a huge estate. You know, we're not necessarily talking millions and millions and millions of dollars as being the only way that you should put your money and protect your assets in a trust.
Yeah, but I'm glad you brought that up. Our clients are middle class, and typically the amount of money they have is less than $1 million.
Right, and that includes your house. I mean, that's
everything.
Yeah.
So it may be anywhere from $400,000 to $700,000-$800,000. I mean, that's typical. And here's the point: whatever it is for you, it's everything, and it's your entire, at least financial legacy for your loved ones. And I would argue one other point that you can make, and going a step further than pointing out that this is not a fortune. Not only is it a substantial amount of money that can make a lot of difference in your children's lives over time, by putting it in this container, you allow them the option of leaving it in the container for your grandkids, even if it's just $200,000. And many of you listening to me may be thinking, look, it's a small amount of money. They would never want to do that. I'm willing to bet many of you are, in fact, doing that right now with 401ks and IRAs. Mm-hmm. And just like you're considering leaving that in, not pulling it out, letting your kids pull it out, give your children the chance to take it to the next generation. And don't think you have to have a fortune to do that. And now we do. We regularly do trust. So you're really providing a benefit for three generations, potentially. With a relatively modest amount of money, allow for the possibility of good investment, good rates of return. There's lots of things that can affect that sum of money over time. You know, we're running out of time, speaking of time. But we've covered a lot of territory. I know I've talked fast. Susan, you've kind of led the conversation in an important way. I hope this was beneficial for you. We look forward to having you join us next week. This has been another episode of Elder Talk. Till then.
You've been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. That's eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.